This morning we began a new series, and I want to say a bit more about that and what to expect from that. For 8 weeks, with the exclusion of Palm Sunday and Easter Sunday, we will have some parallel and related series going on in our morning and evening worship. In the morning, we're outlining our theological values and visions as a congregation. This morning we talked about our core purpose as a local church, about why it is that we exist. For the next 4 Sundays, we'll consider our core values, the things that we highly value that distinguish us, often from other churches in our own theological tradition even, and that we are already working to live out in our life together. Then after a pause for Palm Sunday and Easter, we'll spend 3 Sundays on our aspirational values, on 3 areas we know are important for us as a congregation, but also areas we know that we need to grow. That's our plan for the morning sermon series. But then for many of those sermons, there will be a counterpart sermon in the evening as well with some additional thoughts on that topic. And so one morning sermon will talk about how we approach the Bible here as a congregation. And that evening, we'll say a bit more about why we approach it that way and some of the problematic alternatives that are out there as well. Another morning, we'll talk about the shape of our morning worship service. And then in the evening, we may dig a bit deeper into the sources and practical outcomes of that shape. And so the idea, again, is that someone can simply be attending in the morning and get the big picture overview, but for those who return in the evening, you'll get a deeper explanation and understanding of our theological vision and why it is that it matters. That very statement then, of course, leads us to our main question that we're focusing on tonight, which is, what is a theological vision anyway? This phrase I keep using. With that question in mind, we turn now to our texts. So please do listen carefully. This is God's word for us this evening. First, from 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 5 through 9. Paul writes, "What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants through whom you believed, as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. He who plants and he who waters are one, and each will receive his wages according to his labor. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building." And then from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, I'll read verses 19 through 23, ending a bit earlier than what you have there in the bulletin. Paul writes, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them. To the Jews, I became a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings." This is the word of the Lord. So our question this evening is, what is a theological vision? And to answer that question, I think we need to break it down to a few parts. And so we'll ask a few questions this evening. In what follows, I'm drawing from a number of sources, though chief among them would be Patrick Lencioni and Tim Keller. What I'm calling a theological vision is really a sort of blending of what Lencioni calls clarity of values and strategic planning and what Keller calls theological vision or ministry DNA. How I'm using the term probably doesn't completely overlap with either one, but draws heavily from both. In any case, our goal tonight is to get a better sense of how this kind of theological vision functions in the life of a church like ours. To do that, we'll need to ask a few questions. First will be, where does the theological vision fit? By which I mean, where does it fit in among the other things that we believe? Some of you have heard some of this explanation before, but it's worth clarifying again so we can be clear both about what a theological vision is and what it's not. First, the theological vision is not the basis of our beliefs. That, of course, is the Bible. Second, it's not a statement of our core doctrines. That, for us, is the Westminster Standards. Third, it's also not an outline of our institutional structure and procedures, because for us, that is the Book of Church Order. Rather, a theological vision first assumes all of those things and is built upon that doctrinal foundation. It assumes that doctrinal foundation rather than repeating it, which is why the doctrine of the Trinity or justification by faith do not appear in our theological vision, because those things are much more foundational for us than that. The Scripture is the bedrock of who we are as church. Upon the Scriptures, we have our doctrinal foundations, the essential doctrines of the Christian faith, and also the vital doctrines of Reformed theology. Our theological vision then builds upon that. Its goal is to summarize the values of our particular congregation and how we plan to pursue those in our particular time and place. It might be helpful to think of it this way. You can go on a Sunday to five different PCA churches with the same scriptural bedrock as we have, with the same doctrinal foundation and standards that we have, and yet those five churches, in how they worship and how they do various aspects of ministry, can look very, very different from one another. Those differences are often rooted in different theological values that they're emphasizing. The difference is not whether we believe in the Bible or whether we hold to the same doctrinal standards, but rather it is about what the values we have focused on and how we have sought to apply them. That is where a theological vision fits in relation to other aspects of who we are as a church. Second, we can ask, what is the goal of a theological vision? And the goal of a theological vision is to help us bridge the gap between our doctrinal foundation and the concrete details of how we will do ministry as a church in a way that intentionally keeps with our theological values. We can break that down a bit. We have a core of theology as Christians and as a church, of course. We have that then on one end of things. And then on the other end, we have our particular situation, our specific ministry setting in this congregation, at this particular time and in this particular place, living in this particular culture. And we have those two things, and we need to recognize that there's something of a gap between them. There's an open question of how exactly we will apply our theology to our particular time and place and setting. The connection is not an automatic thing. First, many details of application are left unspoken both in our doctrinal standards and also in the Bible itself. In fact, a huge amount of detail is left unspoken. There's a gap that needs to be bridged. And different churches do that in different ways, depending both on what they value and also what their immediate context is. Different contexts will require different applications in the life of a church. But different values will result in different applications as well. The goal of articulating our theological vision is to be intentional about all three of those things, to be clear about not only our doctrinal beliefs, but about the needs of our particular setting and the values we want to preserve and draw from as we seek to bridge that gap in our ministry and in our life as a church. And so in this series, we're focusing especially on three types of values. The first is our core purpose, and that's what we talked about this morning. That's the purpose of our church and why it was made, to be God's instrument in making, maintaining, and maturing disciples for Jesus Christ. And that, of course, is a key principle that must guide how we do what we do together and to keep us from losing our way in the midst of the details. Our second set of values is our core values. These are things we highly value in how we operate and work, and which we already see are part of our life and ministry as a church. For these, as we've shared before, we've identified four things: deep exposition of the Holy Scriptures, thoughtful and robust liturgical worship, a culture of Reformed Catholicity, and the nurture and equipping of covenant children. We'll say more about each of those in the weeks ahead, but for now the point is that these are some of the key values that we want to guide us in how we do ministry, how we apply our doctrinal beliefs in our ministry practice. And then third are our aspirational values. These are more influenced by our situation because they're things we know are important for us in this time and place, but which we also know we need to improve on. They are both values and areas of needed growth. And for these, we've identified three things: relationships and community, shepherding and discipleship, and evangelism, outreach, and missions. These three categories help us think about the needs of our church in a way that's aimed at preserving our historic biblical values, at taking seriously the needs of this particular moment in the life of our church, and at doing that while not losing sight of our core purpose. That is the goal of our theological vision. That said, as we talk about this, we might wonder, what are the alternatives to a theological vision? We might ask ourselves whether all of this thinking and structuring is really necessary, really important, or whether we are just overthinking things with this. That is a fair question, and to answer it, we then come to that third question, to asking, what are the alternatives to articulating a theological vision? And we could say a lot here, but generally speaking, I want to focus on two main alternatives to articulating a theological vision, which I think are common in church life, broadly speaking. One is modern pragmatism, and the other is historic idealism. Let me unpack those a bit for us. One alternative to building an intentional bridge between what we believe and what our practices are is what we might call modern pragmatism. And what this often looks like is simply the absence of such a bridge. It's a way of operating with a disconnect between what we believe and how we operate as a church. What we believe doctrinally is put in one category, and then our ministry practices, our methodology and ministry is put in another. And in many ways, these two things then are treated as being disconnected. Questions of ministry practice are generally answered pragmatically, not theologically. The main question that's usually asked is, what works? And so we look at what works at other churches, what other churches have done, what has been successful. We look sometimes at what has worked in the business world, and we adapt it for the church if we think that might work. We search for a technical solution, and when we find it somewhere, we simply drop that methodology into our setting in the hopes that it will work just as well here. And sometimes when people do that, it does work. But a lot of times, it doesn't. And when it doesn't, it's often because the method that we adopt with our pragmatic mindset either doesn't fit with our doctrinal beliefs and so causes those internal contradictions, or it doesn't fit with the setting that we're in and the needs there, or it doesn't fit with either. And there's a whole set of books that take this approach that are out there, books that promote a particular methodology in the life of the church, but that have little to say about doctrine or about differences in settings or needs. This approach, on the whole, tends to focus on success and on finding the right technique to achieve it. The other alternative, then, on the other end of things, is what I'll call historic idealism. And if the first approach tends to focus simply on success and technique, then this approach tends to brush those things aside and focus instead on faithfulness and idealism. It brushes aside modern ideas of success and instead says that as long as the church is sound in its doctrine and godly in its character, then all will be well. It can tend to treat the different challenges unique to different settings as of little importance. Of course, the problem is that doctrines and practices of the church still need to be embodied. We need to decide to do them a particular way. Worshiping and preaching and the life of the church still needs to take some sort of concrete form. And so while they may not articulate it this way, the forms that these churches often adopt are forms of whatever historic period they view as a golden age of Christian life. The details of church life and Christian life are often simply transplanted from another time and place in the history of the church to that particular time and place that they admire is what's used. And so whether that time or place is the early church of the 4th century, or Calvin's Geneva, or the 17th century Puritans, or a beloved period of American history, the practices of that age are simply adopted and considered biblical. The preacher often aims to preach like preachers of that historically idealized time. The liturgy is largely copied from that historically idealized time. Often patterns of family life or evangelism or courtship are adopted from that idealized time. And we could go on. Now, to be clear, there's nothing wrong with drawing from and learning from the past. In fact, that's part of what a theological vision seeks to do, as I'll explain in a little bit. But there is a problem with taking one time and place as our ideal for ministry expression in church life, and then ignoring the details of where we are and who we are. It's a problem because it stops trying to connect with and minister to the people who are around us. It's a problem because it tends to ignore the actual modern problems that the people in our church face. And it's especially a problem because it's not the pattern that we see in the ministry of the New Testament church itself. It's not the pattern we see in the Apostle Paul. It's not the pattern we see the Scriptures calling us to. Instead, the Bible calls us to take both our doctrines and our setting seriously. And it does this by calling us to a pattern not of technique-focused pragmatism, nor of disconnected historical idealism, but of the faithful pursuit of fruitfulness. And that's what we see in our passages this evening. Modern pragmatism tells us that with the right technique, we can make success happen in the church. Historic idealism tells us not to worry about success or setting, but Paul gives us instead the image of a gardener, the image of a farmer. This is not the modern image of technical control and success, because it's not something we can control. Paul may plant as he knows, Apollos may water, but neither one of them guarantees the results. Neither one of them can make growth happen. And if they cannot, then we certainly cannot either. Paul reminds us that God is the one who must give the growth. God is the one who brings about fruitfulness, not us. Paul was not a modern pragmatist when it came to ministry. And yet he also wasn't a historic idealist. We know that what he did, he knew that what he did in his work mattered, and that his work had to be both aware of the truth of God and the realities of those that he ministered to. Farming is, after all, a skill. And doing it well means knowing about your seed, knowing about your setting and soil, and knowing about the best way to connect those two things. It is a form of labor, as Paul says in verse 8, but it is skilled labor that requires thoughtfulness about both the seed that is planted and about the time and place that it's planted. It is not historic idealism that brushes aside cultural and chronological differences of setting. It is a thoughtful approach that takes both the seed of the word and the location it must be planted into account. And lest it begin to sound like I'm just running away with my imagination and Paul's metaphor, we can take a look again at 1 Corinthians chapter 9. There, Paul, without any metaphors, makes this point. Who he is ministering to matters in what he does. The setting matters. Paul did not find an idealized way to do ministry in the synagogues of Palestine and then just tell everyone everywhere to copy that. He had no golden age or golden location model that he just dropped down in different places, regardless of the setting, calling it faithfulness. Instead, he became like a Jew when he ministered to Jews. And he became like a Gentile when he ministered to Gentiles. He ministered, he says, to the weak according to their weakness. He became, he writes, all things to all people. And this was not a compromise for him, but rather, as he says in verse 23, I do it all for the sake of the gospel. And we should note that this wasn't just Paul's model for evangelism, but for all of ministry, as in Galatians 2, he went head to head against the Apostle Peter over the fact that Christian Gentiles should not be expected to live like Christian Jews. Setting matters. We are not called to modern pragmatism that separates our theology from our practice. We're also not called to historic idealism that tries to just repeat the patterns of the past. We are called instead to faithfully pursue fruitfulness. We are to plant and water the seed of God's word. We are to do it in a skilled way, aware not just of the properties of the seed, but of the unique properties of our particular soil and our particular season. And we are to go about our work desiring to see growth and fruit while also knowing that we cannot control the outcome, but that the growth must be up to God. That means taking both our doctrine and our setting seriously and seeking to bring them together in wisdom, which is what a theological vision seeks to do, connecting our doctrine to our practice in our particular time and place, and doing it according to our theological values. How, though, we might ask, does this actually play out in the different challenges that we face? Let's consider a couple examples. First, and relevant to our setting, let's ask how articulating a theological vision helps us navigate a generational transition. We are, as we've said, in the midst of a generational transition as a church. This is something the leadership has been talking about for many years. Pastor Rayburn spoke about it when he initiated the pastoral transition. We've seen it as we see younger families among us, as we see a younger church staff, younger leaders among many of our different ministries, and younger men coming onto our session and diaconate. How does articulating our theological vision help us navigate this generational transition? Well, here I'm reminded again of something I mentioned back in September from Herman Bavinck. In his Reformed Dogmatics, Bavinck identifies a law that he says we see at work in every area of life. And particularly, he seems to mean in every area of social and institutional life. And so what is that law? Well, Bavinck explains. He says, on the one hand, there is a revolutionary spirit that seeks to level all that has taken shape historically in order to start rebuilding things from the ground up. On the other hand, he says, there is also a false conservatism that takes pleasure in leaving the existing situation untouched simply because it exists, and in accordance with Calvin's familiar saying, not to attempt to change a well-positioned evil. In other words, Bavinck is identifying two kinds of impulses we have, which I think we feel even more powerfully at times of transition, times of uncertainty, and times of generational change. One is the impulse to blow everything up and start over. Bavinck calls this the revolutionary spirit. We might call it a sense of radical innovation. The other is to keep things the same, whether they're good or not. Bavinck calls this false conservatism. We might call it a rigid traditionalism. Radical innovation destroys much that is good and necessary. A rigid traditionalism, Bavinck explained, usually bogs life down, and in the end, it often radicalizes people even further, so that eventually, though it may be delayed a bit, they reject the tradition altogether in an attempt to restore balance. Neither approach, Bavinck explains, works. Dustin Messer, an Anglican pastor and theologian I went to seminary with, portrayed these two dangers by pairing together two illustrations. The first is a common illustration I know I've heard several times, and it goes like this. A young woman, when she makes a ham for her family, always cuts the ends off of it before putting it in the oven. One day, her husband asks her why she does this, and she says, because that's how my mother always did it. So one day, the young woman asks her mother about the practice, and she says, well, because that's how your grandmother always did it. And so finally, they ask the grandmother why she always cut off the ends of the ham before cooking it, and she says, well, when you were growing up, my roaster was too small to fit the whole thing. What's interesting in that illustration is that the practice made sense at the time it was instituted. But the situation had changed in the following generations, though the practice was observed anyway. The point of the story is that traditions can be silly and unnecessary and even can cause us to do things that hurt our larger goal. In this case, two generations of households trying to cook food for their families, but unnecessarily discarding parts of the meal for no real reason. But, Messer adds, whenever he hears that first illustration, he thinks it's important to add a second. It goes like this. A boy has both red berries and other darker bluish-colored berries growing in his backyard. He only eats the red ones. A friend is over one day and asks him why he doesn't eat the dark blue ones. Because my brother doesn't, he says. They ask the brother why. He says, well, because Dad doesn't. Then the friend tells the boy about the story of the woman with the ham and the silliness of traditions that you don't know the reason for. And so the two boys go and eat a bunch of poisonous dark blue nightshade berries growing in the yard and die. The point, Messer explains, is that if we discard traditions without understanding them, we do so at our own risk. Now, key, I think, in those stories is the understanding them part. That is, after all, the difference between the two illustrations. The women discarded their tradition once they understood the reason for it and the fact that it no longer helped do what it was designed to do. But the boys never came to learn the basis of their tradition of not eating the dark blueberries in the yard, and so they discarded it without knowing why it was there. At times of cultural upheaval and generational transition, there can be a tendency to cling to past practices without knowing why, a rigid traditionalism. But this can often do us harm rather than good because it does not take our new situation into account. In the same way, in times of great change, there's often an impulse to simply discard the past as irrelevant, an approach of radical innovation. But this, too, can often do us harm, often great harm, rather than good, because it does not understand the reason for the older practice and the fact that it might still be relevant and important. The alternative that Bavinck preferred to rigid traditionalism or radical innovation was an attitude of reformation, of receiving past traditions, while also being thoughtful about the need for reform or adjustment to take new situations into account. And a theological vision is necessary to take such a reformed and always reforming approach. A theological vision seeks to identify the key reasons behind our practices, behind what we do. It seeks to explain and remind us of what they are for. This helps us to see when our practices are still helping accomplish something we believe is important, when they have become in some way dated and might need to be updated, and when they're actually starting to get in the way of the goals that they once served, because the situation we're in has changed. In these ways, a theological vision helps us to apply the wisdom of the past to the new situations of the present. And that is what we're seeking to do right now in the life of our church. The key elements of our theological vision that we're trying to articulate here were developed over decades of thoughtful ministry in our congregation. They were articulated by our church's leadership 10 years ago as they sought to distill the values they wanted to pass on to the next generation. And they have been taken up and clarified once again by our leadership today as we seek to navigate our next steps forward. Our goal in all of this is to hold on to the wisdom of the past while facing the challenges and opportunities of the present and the future. That is how a theological vision helps us navigate the big picture process of a generational transition. But we might also wonder, how does it help us in our day-to-day, month-to-month, even year-to-year, more ordinary decisions that we need to make and functions? That brings us to our next question. How does a theological vision help us navigate difficult decisions? This is a point that the writings of Ron Heifetz helped me see more clearly. Heifetz, in his work, makes the point that the most difficult decisions and conflicts that any institution faces is not usually ones where they have to choose between a good thing and a bad thing. It's usually a decision when we need to choose between two good things. It's usually a situation where we need to decide between two competing values. This is often true in society and also true in our relationships, though we rarely acknowledge it. And so while some political issues are black and white ethical issues, and while some talking heads would like us like to paint a picture that every issue is black and white and ethical in that way, the fact is that so many questions of public policy in the end deal with competing values. And those are often the ones that are the hardest to navigate in society. The same can be true in our relationships with friends and with family. Tensions often rise not because one person values a good thing and another values a bad thing, but when people value the same things but disagree about which should trump which when they conflict. You and your spouse might both value saving for the future and the need for time away as a family. But when you only have enough money to do one or the other, those competing values are in conflict, and dealing with that can be painful. You may both value your children's safety and that they learn independence, but when those things are in conflict in a specific situation, you may clash over which one should win out in that case. And the same can be true in the life of a church. Some of the biggest conflicts come when two values that a congregation holds to are in conflict, and people disagree on which should win out in that situation. A theological vision is meant to help us navigate such decisions. It's not a cure-all, it's not a flowchart, it doesn't hand us easy answers, but it helps us be clear on what our important values are. It doesn't lay out every value that we hold to, but those that are especially important to us. And it helps us, when values do compete, to more easily identify which values are competing with which, and to begin to think through which values are really most important to us. After all, as a church, we must make decisions about what to do with the limited time and energy and funds that we have. We could pursue a virtually infinite number of good things as a church, but which ones should we put our resources into right now? Articulating our core purpose, articulating our core values, articulating our most significant needs right now, in other words, articulating a theological vision, helps us to answer those kinds of questions. In that way, our theological vision helps us navigate difficult decisions. Finally, the last question I want to consider is, how does this approach, the theological vision, help us engage with the Lord? I've mentioned a few alternatives to approaching things this way. On the one end, there is historic idealism and rigid traditionalism. On the other end is modern pragmatism and radical innovation. There are a number of reasons we can be drawn to these sorts of alternatives. But I'd also argue that both of these alternatives can be ways of avoiding engaging with the Lord. When we face the challenges of the Christian life, this is not just true of us as a congregation, but this is true of us as individuals, we can feel unstable. We can feel anxious and afraid. And our tendency is often to try to grasp onto something that will make us feel safe and secure once again. But our temptation is often to grasp onto something other than the Lord. When we face anxiety and uncertainty, then historic idealism and rigid traditionalism can be appealing because they tell us that someone else has already figured out how to handle this problem, and all we need to do is follow what they did. Whatever age we point back to, whatever tradition we lay hold of, whether it's what the Puritans did a few centuries ago or what our own congregation did starting just a few decades ago, it tells us that we can place our trust in some other group of people in the past to save us from the uncertainty of the present. But as we've said, that may feel safe, but it can quickly become an idol for us, something we place far more hope in than we should. On the other end, when we feel anxiety and uncertainty, then modern pragmatism and radical innovation can be appealing because it tells us that we can figure out how to solve the problems we face. It tells us often that we are smarter than other people, than other Christians, than other churches in the past, and we can succeed where they failed. It tells us that we can get the right technique, and then we can control the very situation that's making us so anxious. But this, too, is a false hope. This, too, is an idol. It's an idolatrous trust in ourselves. It's something that churches can face. It's something that we can face individually in our own lives. By contrast, to approach the challenges we face not with ready-made solutions, but with our doctrinal foundation, with our theological values rooted in the wisdom of the past, and with our eyes on the challenges of the present, approaching things that way often doesn't feel very safe. It doesn't feel certain, and it pushes us away from false confidence to seeking wisdom and guidance from the Lord, both individually and corporately. It often forces us to prayer. It often requires us to walk by faith. And as we think about this in various settings, it's helpful to remember that that's the pattern we see so often in the Scriptures. We can sometimes miss how often things changed in the setting of the history of God's people, as they went from the patriarchs to being a nation, as they went from wandering in the desert to being settled in the land, as they went from the tabernacle to the temple, as they went from judges to kings, as they went from exile back home, as they went from Israel to the church. In the Bible, we're given a number of detailed instructions for some of those time periods, particularly early on. But it's also amazing how many things are not laid out in detailed instructions in the Scriptures. It's amazing how many things are left unaddressed. Instead, the Bible gives a doctrinal foundation, it gives an ethical foundation, and then it calls God's people to seek wisdom, it calls them to prayer, it calls them to walk by faith. That has a lot of implications, but one of them is that it forces us to wrestle with the Lord, to go to Him, and to rely on Him, and to ask for His help. It forces us to be engaged with Him as we seek to learn how to apply His truth to the ever-changing challenges that we face. It's true for our congregations, it's true for our lives, as we see over and over again as the seasons of our lives change. It's not an easy task, but it is a good one. It is a reminder, once again, that we do not know exactly where we are going, but we know that the one that we follow is good. And so, grounded in His Word, clinging firmly to His truth, learning from the wisdom of the past, and with our eyes opened to the present, let us seek to follow the Lord faithfully in the hopes of bearing fruit here and now, in this particular season, in this particular soil, so that we might reap a spiritual harvest that will last with Him forever. Amen.